I guess I kind of wanted to start off by asking you, Ed, really, how are you doing?
How am I doing? So well, I really do look every day now as, so far so good, right? I'm still alive. I'm not sick, knock on wood. This morning I've been gone for I was gone for 31 days on a an assignment doing a series of stories from Los Angeles to New Orleans. I got back Sunday night. So that means that technically I'm in my house as my wife and also our 22-year-old daughter who's living here because of COVID. She's not hasn't moved into New York City yet. She works with Google. She just graduated. Anyway, so I'm the one who's come back and stay away from me, right? Because we have no idea except in from 2 weeks from now or if I get a test. So anyway, so this morning when you ask how am I doing, I woke up. My wife is like coughing, she sneezes, she says she doesn't feel well, and my heart just sank. So how I feel is a day-to-day thing, right? Thank goodness she's okay. But it's so touch and go, right? Because unfortunately, we're and this connects to a much larger existential answer to your question, how am I doing? That I'll just be quite blunt, under the Trump administration in this period of time, it's impossible to actually feel okay because there is such a lack of leadership, a lack of clarity, a lot of concern for the other. And what is so sad to me and actually makes me incredibly pissed off because I've now just experienced it going through five states in the southwestern United States to the south. Is that we really do have a divided nation now in a way that I've never experienced before, where there are those who actually believe in QAnon, and there are those who believe that COVID is something that's made up, and those who believe that this is a democratic socialist plot to destroy Donald Trump. And you just want to like shoot yourself in the head. No, you don't. You want to just like throw your arms up and go, how the hell can it be? How could this have happened?
I wasn't going to go
How do
there.
I feel? I'm troubled. I'm anxious. I'm angry as hell, but I remain hopeful that we will prevail. And, I'm proud to be a New Yorker and New Jersey, East Coast American who we actually paid attention to the facts. And the reality is we were the epicenter, and now there's almost no cases. So.
I wasn't going to go there, but you said that the country's very divided. And is this the most divided you've seen this country in your entire lifetime, or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was 10 when Richard Nixon was elected in 68. So I certainly remember that time because I even from that age I was politically engaged. Actually, age of 10, at the age of 10, I stuffed envelopes for Hubert Humphrey who was the guy running against Nixon. So from an early age, I was politically aware and engaged as much as I could be at that age. And while there were the anti-war demonstrations and the riots in Chicago and all those things happening, I guess it's hard for me to know if we were more divided then. But I will say that certainly in my lifetime, I've never seen us so divided. And what's so troubling is that we're not actually divided on substance. We're divided on fiction. On fiction, on because we can't now, because of Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and the sort of whole kind of conservative right wing, and then God knows what the Russians or the Iranians or the Chinese are doing, to sort of further foment division, right? Just to destabilize us. And I'm not a paranoid person, but I do believe, certainly with the Russians, that they have done that and will continue to do that. But anyway, that we're living in a time where we can't agree on the most basic facts. And in a sense, COVID is like a dramatic and troubling illustration of that, where it's like, we can all get this, guys. right? Like our mothers, our grandmothers, our, you know, everybody can get this. So why would you refuse to believe it? You know, why? So this blind devotion to Trump or whomever, this sort of is pretty freaky, actually. I've never seen anything like this. And so
going earlier again, you mentioned a 30-day trip. Just for context, what was that trip?
So I had been commissioned by Jyllands Posten, which is one of the two main dailies in Denmark, to go with one of their reporters from Los Angeles to New Orleans. And we did the first 30 days of what will be a 100-day journey across America for this newspaper to the run-up to the election.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I did the first 30 days, just finished, you know, so we went through, you know, we started in LA, so we did Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and Louisiana. And Texas is a big state. I knew that, but driving, because we drove it, it's like, wow. It's a big state. But you know, you guys have a humongous country, so you know what big territory is.
But was there anything in particular on that trip that kind of struck you?
I think well, partly the division that I alluded to earlier, and also kind of I don't know. I think that's the thing that sticks out the most is the way people are divided, and but also, you know, the sort of the racial injustice that you know, because some of the stories we did highlighted that, you know, that has now been brought to light and is inescapable now. You know, this is something I have always cared about and I've thought about and I've even maybe done work on. But even, you know, I'm 62 years old and I have to admit that even now I am learning, not so much learning facts, which I am, new facts, but almost like learning a feeling of outrage, or like, how could this have been? It's a fascinating process internally to realize, like, I've known all the facts about slavery, like this is nothing new, but somehow I'm feeling it in a way that I've never felt before. It's so visceral, and it's again, it's one of those moments where it's like, how the hell did we let this happen for hundreds of years? And then moreover, there are still people who think it's okay.
Mm.
And so those are the sort of, if you want, like impassioned or driving forces that I'm feeling right now. And yeah, so I don't know if that answers your question. And I would like to also sort of, not preface, but you know, kind of like qualify everything by saying most people in the United States of America are good and decent people. The way majority of people are good and decent people. Unfortunately, we're living at a time where the extremists have the megaphone. And with social media, it is amplified in a way that is not real, actually. It doesn't reflect the, you know, reality of whatever proportion and numbers on the ground, you know? And so I think it particularly impacts the folks on the right who seem to be like inflamed to a point where they're in my mind irrational in the way they see things. Like, I really do connect this to Fox News. I connect this to to sort of the, you know, or whatever it is, One America and Newsmax and all these like super conservative, you know, even farther right to Fox News organizations, that they're not news organizations. These are truly purely propagandist arms of conservative movement. And
Chris Wallace he seems like a decent journalist, though. So
yeah, Chris Wallace, Brett Baer, no, there's a few journalists there at Fox that absolutely are trying to do their job, in my eyes, as a photojournalist, you know, trying to do their job decently. But My concern is that what it becomes like a cancer on the body politic. So that in fact, it's like it's a cancerous growth, and it creates this unnatural and unnecessary division amongst us. And one of the knockoff effects of that is that we can't get very much done, especially for the common good.
Got it. Now, how would you say this pandemic has truly, in what way has it impacted your life the most? What aspect of it?
I can't travel the way I'm normally on the road 8 months out of the year. And I mean, I know I just came from a month away, but you know, that seems to be a little bit of an aberration in time of COVID. But that was probably it, that I've spent more time in the last, since March 7th, whatever that is, 6 months, 5 months, I've spent more time home than continuously than I have in probably literally the last 30 years.
And that means more time with family?
More time with my wife, the most time we've ever spent together. Happy to report that it hasn't pulled us apart. It's actually brought us closer together. And I think she'll actually agree with me. I mean, that's the most material impact, if you like, right? Obviously, there's the sort of psychological impact of, you know, as I started the conversation, you know, kind of waking up every morning, making sure I can still smell and, you know, going through the checklist of like things, you know, is my throat sore, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, do I have a fever? I mean, I'm not neurotic about it, but it is something that is haunting. We've lost, a neighbor to COVID. We lost a someone who was pretty close to us, helped raise our son as his baseball coach and our contractor.
Andy. I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
You know, he died. And so it's sort of like, you know, and it's like, what do you do with this? What do you do when, right? You know, like, how can we have relationships that move us forward if we can't agree on the most basic set of facts?
Mm-hmm.
And this is beyond politics. It's beyond politics.
Mm.
I love smart Republicans. You know, smart Republicans, good-hearted conservatives, in the end, they probably make us better as a society. Because it's part of the checks and balances. They'll bring point of views that maybe folks on the other side of the aisle don't think about or whatever. You know, that's part of like a civil society and a democracy, is that we're not all the same. We don't all believe the same thing. But what we do believe in is civil discourse and a desire to make things better for everyone. But now we have this frankly, Trump is not a Republican. He's just a freak of nature. And he's an absolutely horrible human being, besides a terrible leader. And I will say, unfortunately, a very effective politician in the age of social media, in the age of celebrity, right? But, you know, like I hunger for a time. And I hope the Democrats win the presidency and flip the Senate. But one thing I'm hoping that if that happens, they don't become like the other side, that they don't become vindictive and take the reins of power and then create the same terrible, you know, lopsided balance of power where, again, nothing gets done, you know. So anyway, and I don't mean to say this, I don't mean this like in a jingoistic way, but because of the position the United States holds in the world, the influence it has and so forth, you know, the role modeling that it can have, to have a leader like this, it's, you know, it empowers the Duartes and the, you know, and the Erdogans and the Putins. And there's unfortunately a big list of people, the ruler in Hungary, you know, that it empowers them, Bolsonaro in Brazil, it empowers these otherwise, it empowers these other leaders to behave really badly.
Mm.
And so, and of course, there's the environmental impacts, global warming, you know, like there's all these things that, because we are inextricably connected, Well, you guys have no choice, unfortunately. Well, I lament sort of the fate of Canada and Mexico, that you're the neighbor of this whatever superpower, this hugely powerful country, because when we behave poorly, it can't help but have some impact on you guys. But
well, yeah, they put tariffs on our aluminum, calling us a national security threat. But right. I just want to bring it back here to the work that you did recently.
Yes.
And I want to ask you if you could, you know, tell us about your photo series, Rising to the Call.
Yeah. Well, you know, that work, that project was an example of a kind of, you know, an organic personal project that, you know, I come home on March 7th. It's clear that, like, you know, all my work is shut down, assignments canceled, projects in the future are now on hold. I'm suddenly home full time. So not so much panicking, like, what am I going to do? But thinking more like, okay, what am I going to do with this time? So the first thing I started to do was volunteer at a local food kitchen in my community of 40,000 people, Montclair, New Jersey. We're 12 miles west of Manhattan. You know, so I started to do that. And then of course I'm like, well, I live to work. I live to create stories. So what am I, you know, I'm trying to think, how do I engage with what's going on? That's what I always ask. How do I engage with what's going on in the world? Well, when all of a sudden my world is shrunk to sort of technically my home, but I am an essential worker. So I figured, okay, well, I can extend that to my state. And then I thought, well, look at, you know, look what's going on with these people volunteering and these organizations and you know, nonprofits and, you know, the local YMCA delivering 40,000 meals a week. And, you know, so everything from, like, you know, a group of suburban moms making, you know, 10,000 masks to, you know, university engineering students making plastic shields for local hospitals. I was like, this is so inspiring. And for once I can, or, you know, I can tell a story about, you know, how individuals and organizations are rising to this moment to, you know, to not only give hope, but to have direct impact on it. Right. And so that was the idea. That was the inspiration. And then working with my studio manager as sort of researching, we just started to do research, like, constantly, you know, what stories are out there? What are we hearing about? Oh, there's a distillery in Cape May, New Jersey, that instead of making gin is now making hand sanitizer. And, you know, we just took it from there. And I would say for a 2.5 month period, almost every day I was going out to photograph one of these things. And then somewhere about 2/3 of the way through creating this work, I pitched it to the New York Times, and thankfully they saw it worthy to be picked up. And then it was published in an op-ed section, you know, online of the New York Times. And so, you know, hopefully theoretically it reached a lot more people. And I guess that's why you guys have reached out to me. But, you know, it often, as a photojournalist and with the kind of work I do as a documentarian, I deal with, you know, kind of, you know, tough issues and things that, you know, let's say problems in the world. And so this was an opportunity to highlight something good.
Was there a particular moment that stuck with you in terms of this process of taking these photos, or?
Well, let's see. I would say the few moments that really stuck out were going to this YMCA that's maybe 10, 15 minutes away from me, big YMCA, and one of the things they were doing is food distribution. And then walking out into the parking lot at 9 a.m. and seeing literally a one mile long line of cars, double wide, waiting to get food. So they started lining up at 7 a.m. food starts to be distributed at 11 in the morning. And boy, you talk about like the magnitude where it's like right in your face, the magnitude of need that this pandemic has caused in what is one of the richest states in America. New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the United States. And it's also, it's got to be in the top five wealthiest states as well. And yet, and who did you see mostly in those cars? Black and brown people, working class people, right? So, you know, that was sort of one of those like gut punches, like, wow, this is pretty horrific. But then in the same facility, they opened their daycare center to the children of first responders and frontline workers. So, and for free, they were taking in these folks' children. So in one place, you saw the magnitude of desperation, if that's the right word, need, okay, not to editorialize, just real need, food insecurity. But at the same time, you're seeing this beautiful, beautiful extension of giving and caring for people in the community. So that is one example, and there's many that makes me want to cry because it just, you know, in doing this work, when you get to see, you know, the best of people and the best of us, organizations, whatever, it, you know, it just not only gives you hope, but it just fills my heart. You know, and I can't tell you how many times I experienced that. And of course, the other most sort of blatant example was volunteer EMS workers. Even in a normal time, to be a volunteer EMS worker is pretty amazing, right? Mm-hmm. You're not getting paid to save the lives of your people in your community. But to do it during a time of pandemic where you truly risk dying, getting sick and dying, pretty amazing. So, you know, in that sense, it was almost like when the project reached its natural end, not only because it got published, but because it was kind of like, actually, thankfully, things were sort of calming down in the New York, New Jersey area. I almost felt like a sadness that I wouldn't keep on like getting a chance to meet all these amazing people and see all these life affirming acts. Hmm.
It's like moving imagery that you wouldn't regularly get without these circumstances. And it makes me think a lot about what we said earlier about how, like, you know, the media is creating a lot of like division, whether it be Fox News. And I think a lot of that is, as an outsider looking in, it's all this imagery. They show a lot of imagery that's meant to create, like, spark something in someone, right? It's meant to like trigger people to have a reaction. So with your work, I mean, do you what kind of message do you try to convey with your work? Because I think no matter what, you're always trying to convey some sort of message.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and it just depends on the nature of the project I'm working on. But, you know, especially these days, a lot of the work I do is what I consider advocacy journalism, you know, where there's an explicit desire or, you know, intention to have impact and on the issue or on the situation that I'm chronicling. But in this case, with Rising to the Call, it was really just about getting a positive message out there at a time where, you know, people are probably pretty desperate and in need of knowing that A, they're not alone, B, look at all these people around us, right? This isn't someplace far away. It's in our own, literally in my own back, in your own backyard, that all this stuff is happening, you know, and that we can't give up hope and we will prevail. You know, we'll lose folks, but we will prevail. Yeah, that's it. It's simple in a way, in this particular case, you know, it's a simple equation, if you like.
Your work with like Paradox Nation, when you went, I guess, to the Middle East, is that correct? Like,
or to Pakistan. That's
Pakistan.
That's specifically work I did over many years back and forth going to Pakistan. Yeah.
Yeah. I found that fascinating. I mean, I also noticed that it was like the 90s, it was 98, right? And you shot mainly on film. So, how would you say the process has changed since back then?
Oh, well, I mean, it's easier to shoot in digitally, that's for sure.
Yeah.
For photographers who have never shot on film, it's hard for them to appreciate how much harder it was technically to work with film. But I love the digital workflow. I'm so excited that I got to live through this and you know, be a part of this moment, because it's done is allowed me to be more creative, more productive, more efficient in some ways. I have no nostalgia for film.
I mean, I noticed also in recent projects you do more video as well. So do you find yourself multi kind of media type of work? Do you think you're going to try that more?
Well, I mean, I'm a full-on filmmaker now, probably 60%, sometimes 70% of my work is in video, working in video. I love being a still photographer, and I will continue to be a still photographer, but video has become a beautiful new tool in my toolkit, really. You know, a way of telling stories that in some ways is even way more challenging than working in still photography. And it's also more encompassing and allows me to also tell stories about things that might not be visual and yet be able to bring them to life in a way that I never could with just still photography.
It appears to me that when, you know, there's some sort of like a national crisis, I guess 9/11 was a good example, but...
Or like a hurricane or something, you know, like a terrible disaster.
But normally these things bring us together in the United States. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, sorry. Sorry to disappoint you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I lay the blame squarely on Donald Trump, that just because he's a leader that only gains power by dividing people. And so invariably that means when there is a national crisis, also he's so particularly, not just narcissistic, but so obsessed with himself that it's impossible for him to put the concern, the needs of others ahead of his own needs. So, you know, unfortunately, like, look at George W. Bush. I hated George W. Bush. He started two wars, one war that absolutely made no sense and opened a Pandora's box and, you know, horrible. One of the largest foreign policy blunders in the history of this country. And he represented, you know, a lot of the same dynamics of the conservative movement, you know, stripping environmental regulation, so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, George Bush is not an evil human being. You know, in fact, he seems to be actually a pretty decent human being. And when it came time and after 9/11 or other crises that hit during his presidency, you know, he still had enough human empathy and enough ability as a leader to put his personal needs, definitely his personal needs, but even his political predilections aside. And unfortunately, Trump just cannot do that. And so what happens is now we look to our governors, right? So, you know, you have, you know, Andrew Cuomo in New York or Governor Murphy in New Jersey, or even some Republican governors, DeWine in Ohio, who've done a really fantastic job. This is not about politics. This is just about simply leadership. When the moment came, did you rise up to the call? Did you look at your state and go, okay, we're not going to get any guidance or leadership from on the national level, but so I'm going to have to figure out what I'm going to do, whether it's how am I going to get ventilators, how am I going to get PPE, or what mandates am I going to lay down about mask wearing or social distancing, so forth and so on. So thankfully, we've had individual states with leaders, again, from both sides, both parties, that have done a pretty fantastic job. But what's happened is, because there were so many governors that followed Trump, whether out of fear or truly believing in him, that now we suffer with this pandemic you know, rolling all over the place and spreading. Part of leadership is showing concern for the people that you lead.
Thank you very much for joining us and giving us your time. You know, it's interesting, really interesting to hear your sites, especially since you've done this road trip. And I know from ourselves, we're very appreciative. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Ed. Appreciate it.
Take care, guys. Be well.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.